Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
We start by talking about how it is that Christ himself introduces friendship as a Christian mystery, as a reality of the Christian life, as a point of reflection in Christian theology. It's also Christ whom we can point that sets us to talk about friendship in general, not just friendship with God, which is the theme of our retreat, but anytime we talk about friendship with God or the love of God, because the command to love is double, to love God and to love neighbor. To talk about friendship with God involves then how it is in charity we talk about friendship with each other, friendship with others. And so that's what I'd like to reflect on this morning. And we just begin with maybe the sobering realization that friendship today is somewhat in trouble. Friendship today is somewhat in trouble. One of the ironies that mark modern life is this: although technology has multiplied the ways for people to communicate, and although we have media now that defines itself as social, more people report feeling alienated and isolated from others. This wasn't supposed to happen, at least according to the media companies that have made communication easier. These companies have poured billions of dollars into putting tools of communication into every office, into every home, and indeed into every pocket. It turns out, however, that multiplying short, digital, and often anonymous communication does not suffice to create connection, much less affection, between human beings. Although people communicate more, as they communicate all day, in fact, and often into the night, they report having few to no friends. Truth be told, friendship has suffered culturally for some time now. In art, in the academy, in politics, friendship represents something of a forgotten topic. Artists rarely depict it. Scientists and intellectuals rarely study it. Politicians rarely promote it. It appears that our culture has lost its taste for friendship, at least according to how our grandparents and great-grandparents would have understood and lived it. Friendship as a school of virtue is today viewed as a quaint, old-fashioned idea. Instead, the few types of friendship that catch the culture's eye today are those that cloak vice, especially of a sexual kind. Our newspapers and our novels obsess over human relationships tinged with sexual interest. Our culture today, from Broadway to boardrooms to classrooms, fails to appreciate friendship beyond being a means to sexual gratification. It was not always this way. Since its foundation, Western culture has prized friendship as natural, necessary, and normal. The ancient pagans and the early Christians agreed that no one can live life without friends. Many friends, in fact, and of various kinds. Human life is a shared life, they recognized. Life is not worth living, at least it cannot be lived well, without sharing it with others. No man is an island, John Donne wrote at the dawn of modernity, echoing the wisdom of the ancients. Even some of today's best lyricists repeat this truth. My friends are goals. We fly. Why cry? Our souls exposed. Yeah. We smoke. We laugh. Your stress, my stress, closer than kin, I'm blessed, you blessed. Bonus points to whoever can name who wrote those lyrics. Since the time of the apostles, friendship has enjoyed a privileged place in the Christian life. Think, for example, of the many mentions of his friends that St. Paul makes in his letters. Barnabas, Silas, Timothy, Tychicus, Epaphras, Onesimus, Phoebe, Prisca, Aquila. These are just a few of the people with whom St. Paul shared his life and mission. And we can point to other examples. One friendship especially remembered in the Christian tradition is that between St. Basil the Great and St. Gregory Nazianzen. In the liturgy for their feast day, the church reads a letter of St. Gregory in which he describes his friendship with St. Basil. What St. Gregory describes in his letter remains a model for Christian friendship. I'd like to take a moment just to walk through a bit some of that letter with you. You have it, excerpts of it on your handout. Basil and I were both in Athens. We had come like streams of a river from the same source in our native land, and separated from each other in the pursuit of learning, and were now united again as if by plan. For God so arranged it. Harkening back to our first talk, there are various communicaciones that Gregory identifies here that he shares with Basil. What are they? Can you see them? Can you name them? What are the social networks that they find themselves in even before they meet and get to know each other?
Same city.
Same city, so they share the same political good?
They share the same, like water in a sense, like river.
Okay, well,
same,
I mean,
share the same, land?
Sure. I would say even before that, I mean, what's being pointed out to you, they share the same homeland. They're from the same area. So it's not only that they currently live in the same city and are fellow citizens, they also share an origin. Kind of a homeland. So that's two.
Although it seems they learned differently, they were both in the pursuit of learning.
That's right. So they're in the same community of learning, you know. So at least those three things can unite them before they even meet each other. They're from the same place, they're in the same city, and they're engaged in the same pursuit. All those three. Or social contacts, social networks. They share something already. Something already binds them before they meet and begin to converse. What's also important here is Gregory's admission at the very beginning of his reflections that regards his friendship with Basil as a fruit of divine providence. That even before they meet, God has arranged things widely. They live in the same city. They have the same homeland. They're around the same age so that they're pursuing their studies together. God gives them a common origin. He allows them for a time to be separated, but then to bring them together again. We see that in God's providence, ordering all good things well. You know, we can draw from this in Gregory's sense that God just likes to make friends. And theirs is just one example. Gregory goes on to describe the development of his friendship with Basil. I was not alone at that time in my regard for my friend, the great Basil. I knew his irreproachable conduct and the maturity of his conversation. I sought to persuade others, to whom he was less well known, to have the same regard for him. Many fell immediately under his spell, for they had already heard of him by reputation and hearsay. Here we see that within the providential communicatio that Gregory and Basil enjoyed, the conversatio of their friendship begins. There's initial attraction. Gregory's part to Basil's native goodness and his virtue. And what's interesting here is that Gregory describes the non-possessive quality of his attraction. It's not something that Basil's goodness is not something that he has to possess particularly and individually. The good that he sees in Basil, he recognizes immediately as something that can be shared with others. Others can enjoy this too, and he wants others to enjoy it. He wants Basil to be known by others. There's a kind of virtuous kind of diffusion here of the friendship and not a vicious kind of self-possession. What was the outcome? Almost alone of those who had come to Athens to study, he was exempted from the customary ceremonies of initiation, for he was held in higher honor than his status as a first-year student seemed to warrant. Gregory delights in here. He celebrates the achievements and the privileges of his friend. Again, there's no focus on himself or on the self. He doesn't seek to know and to have others know Basil out of any sense of self-interest or self-benefit. Rather, the pride that one would ordinarily have in oneself for one's achievements, that same pride Gregory takes in Basil, not in himself. Here we see that within friendship, or within the love of friendship, the achievements, the honors of my friend are my own. I share in them in some way. I delight in them. They don't need to be mine. It suffices that they're ours. Such was the prelude to our friendship. So we're not even at friendship yet. Friendship properly so called. Such was the prelude to our friendship, the kindling of that flame that was to bind us together. In this way, we began to feel affection for each other. When in the course of time we acknowledged our friendship and recognized that our ambition was a life of true wisdom, we became everything to each other. We shared the same lodging, the same table, the same desires, the same goal. Our love for each other grew daily, warmer and deeper. Here we get a sense in Gregory's testimony that friendship takes time. Friendship is not infatuation, or the kind of quick relationships that can arise out of infatuation. There's rather a natural progression, a natural logic to making friends. There's an initial sensual attraction, sensual in the best sense of the term, fullest sense of the term. Not sexual, but a delight to the senses. This eventually leads to emotional affection, and then finally to rational love. So the initial delight he took in Basil's obvious good leads to a kind of emotional attachment and a real love for the good of the other, which is then finally deepened when they admit in a conversation of their friendship and their wanting to be friends. Their love becomes reasonable, rational. And it's this that leads to true friendship, a manifestation of mind and heart to each other, which leads then to the sharing of life. Their friendship is expressed in living in common lodging, common table, fostering common desires, pursuing common goals. Friends live life together. They share life together. The same hope inspired us, the pursuit of learning. This is an ambition especially subject to envy. Yet between us there was no envy. On the contrary, we made capital out of our rivalry. A rivalry consisted not in seeking the first place for oneself, but in yielding it to the other, for we each looked on the other's success as his own. We all know that The life of the university, the life of study, is a life of rivalry and competition, constant comparison one to another. Gregory admits this. Says that the university, this kind of learning environment or learning community, can be a danger for friendship, an obstacle to friendship, but it wasn't for them. And the common goal, the pursuit of learning, they loved each other as friends, shared that learning as friends, and shared the achievements of their learning as friends. Gregory simply helps us to see that as we love the friend as another self, we love his good as our good. And therefore, where there could be competition, in fact, where there may be competition, there's no rivalry. They share in the pursuit of individual goods and delight in the pursuit of the common good. We seem to be two bodies, but one spirit. Though we cannot believe those who claim that everything is contained in everything, yet you must believe that in our case, each of us was in the other and with the other. This everything is contained in everything, this is, he's making an allusion to the pre-Socratic philosopher Anaxagoras, who developed the everything in everything thesis as a way of explaining change and development. Basically, all the elements and ingredients of the entire cosmos are contained in everything. And so it's just kind of one big soup that just kind of keeps moving around and morphing into different things, coming in and out. And the various things that we observe come in and out of existence through the constant movement of everything and everything. So Gregory's saying that's not true. But there's a way in which, in their friendship, everything of Basil was in Gregory, everything in Gregory was in Basil in terms of their shared life. We seem to be two bodies with a single spirit. Our single object and ambition was virtue and a life of hope in the blessings that are to come. We wanted to withdraw from this world before we depart from it. With this end in view, we ordered our lives and all our actions. We followed the guidance of God's law and spurred each other on to virtue. It is not too boastful to say we found in each other the standard and rule for discerning right from wrong. For friends who are baptized, their friendship becomes the means to the pursuit of virtue and salvation. They share not only life together, but the Christian life together. They share not only the pursuit of the temporal good together, but of the eternal good together. And they share in the pursuit not only of the various material means to temporal happiness, they share also in all of the spiritual means God gives us for our eternal happiness. This means that we can have a companion in the Christian life with whom we develop the theological virtues together. We learn how to make acts of faith, hope, and love with our friends, and we unite in the performance of the works of charity and mercy together. In this way, friends can be for each other sources of consolation and encouragement. The Christian life is not easy. Being drawn into heaven involves a lot of difficulty, a lot of sacrifice, a lot of struggle. It's helpful to have a friend to share that with. And as Gregory says, friends can be for each other living measures of perfection and of one's own perfection. Again, there's comparison. There can even be competition, but no rivalry. Different men have different names, which they owe to their parents or to themselves, that is, to their own pursuits and achievements. But our great pursuit, the great name that we wanted, was to be Christians, to be called Christians. Here Gregory drives home the point that the Christian tradition will pick up and develop, that friendship should be regarded as an integral part of the Christian life. There is no living the Christian life without friends. As social and political creatures, we do not pursue salvation alone. Grace heals and elevates not only our individual character, but also our social and political character. So it's not a surprise that in the life of grace, there are social and political characteristics that are integral to the life, that grace heals and elevates, that the communion of the church has its destiny in the communion of saints in heaven. Within the community of charity that is the church, the love that we have for all, the love that we're made capable of exercising towards all as an expression of charity, develops into a real friendship, real friendships with a few. So it's a beautiful letter there, you know, from Gregory about his friendship with St. Basil. I look forward to it every January, second or third, on their feast day. Yeah, it's always right after Christmas, so it's kind of appropriate. It's got, in the incarnation, becomes, you know, friends with us. Right away, the church gives us an example of how to become friends in that friendship with God, how to become friends with each other. And so we would do well to ponder often the grace and beauty of Basil and Gregory's friendship. It remains a model and a measure for our own friendships. But I would suggest there's a temptation that we have to avoid in pursuing this kind of friendship. Just as today the only friendship that interests the culture is the sexual one, so we can become interested as Christians in only the spiritual kind of friendship. In other words, we can so desire the highest form of friendship that we neglect to develop the others. In the Middle Ages, St. Elred of Rouveau composed a treatise on Christian friendship that, if read incorrectly, can suggest that the only friends that we should make are heavenly ones. For example, and this is the passage you have on your handout, "This is that great and wonderful happiness we await. God himself acts to channel so much friendship and charity between himself and the creatures he sustains, and between the classes and order he distinguishes, and between each and every one he elects, that in this way, each one may love another as himself. Now, this means each may rejoice over his own happiness as he rejoices over his neighbor's. Thus, the bliss of all individually is the beatitude of all together." There are no thoughts there. He's talking about glory, heaven. There, no thoughts are concealed, no affections disguised. The true and eternal friendship that begins here is perfected there. Here it belongs to the few, for few are good, but there it belongs to all, for there all are good. Here, where wise men and fools brush shoulders, testing is needed, but there none is needed, for an angelic and in some ways divine perfection makes everyone happy. Henceforth, let us compare to this model the friends we love no less than ourselves. For as all their secrets are revealed to us, so we disclose all ours to them, because in everything they are firm, reliable, and steadfast. Do you think any human exists who does not desire to be so loved? It's true that every Christian should strive to develop the friendship that St. Elred describes here. I mean, he's describing ultimately the friendship that is present in the communion of saints and how, by God's grace, it begins even now. It was this friendship, kind of friendship, that was enjoyed by Saints Basil and Gregory and by so many other saintly pairs in the church's history. But as St. Thomas Aquinas reminds us, when it comes to friendship, the perfect should not be the enemy of the good. Perfect should not be pursued to the exclusion of the imperfect. Following Aristotle, Aquinas recalls that human life is ornamented by a variety of friendships. Not all equal in value, to be sure, but all necessary to the flourishing of human life. In Book 8 of his Nicomachean Ethics, Aristotle writes that there are three kinds of friendship: the friendship of pleasure, the friendship of utility, and the friendship of virtue. All three are distinct for Aristotle because they all have different ends, different goods that they pursue. And because they all involve different goods, different ends, the three types of friendship require different loves. Only the last of the three friendships, the friendship of virtue, represents friendship in the proper sense. And only it can endure through the whole of life. Still, the other two represent imperfect kinds of unions and require imperfect kinds of loves that are unions and loves nevertheless, however inferior they are to the union and love of virtuous friendship. Aristotle writes, there are three kinds of friendship corresponding to the objects of love. In each of these, a recognized return of love is possible, and those loving can mutually will good according to their love. So here Aristotle simply observes that all three kinds of friendship are friendship in the proper sense, even if one of them is only friendship in the perfect sense. For in all three kinds of friendship, the good can be wished one to another. Some good can be wished one to another. Three different kinds of good, again, to be sure, but good nonetheless. Of those who love one another for utility, one does not love the other for the other's sake, but for the good that they mutually gain. The same is true for those who love for pleasure. For friends like these do not love witty people because of their character, but because they are pleasant companions. But those who love for utility love for the good they get, and those who love for the sake of pleasantness love for the pleasure they enjoy. These do not love a friend because he is a friend, but because he is useful or pleasant. Therefore, these friendships are incidental, for man is loved not for what he is, but for some advantage or pleasure. So from Aristotle's point of view, friendships of utility and friendships of pleasure are clearly inferior forms of friendship. They do not involve love of friends for the friend's sake, but for some good that we derive from the friends. We love ourselves ultimately in these friendships. Still, Aristotle observes, we wish friends of utility and friends of pleasure some good, and they wish us some good. As a result, friends of utility and friends of pleasure become companions in life as long as the utility and the pleasure last. And by having friends like this, friends of utility, friends of pleasure, the burdens of life are mutually lifted. Life becomes easier, life becomes more pleasant. Life is still shared in some way, even if not perfectly. Aristotle continues, perfect friendship, however, is friendship between men who are good and resemble one another according to virtue. For those who are alike in virtue wish one another good inasmuch as they are virtuous. And they are virtuous in themselves. Friends who wish good to friends for their sake are the truest friends. They do this for the friends themselves and not for something incidental. Friendship between such men remains as long as they are virtuous. When St. Thomas comments on Aristotle's observations here, comparing and contrasting the friendships of pleasure and utility and the friendship of virtue, Aquinas is careful not to oppose the friendship of virtue to the other two kinds of friendship. Again, there's a temptation that we might have as Christians, as desirous of the highest form of friendship, to want to pursue that one only. And Aquinas recognizes, whereas, yes, there is one kind of friendship that is the highest, it's not to be regarded as being opposed to the other two kinds. Rather, Aquinas sees how the perfection found in the friendship of virtue takes up and accommodates the imperfections of the friendships of pleasure and utility. After all, Aquinas says, and you have this quote on your sheets, each friend is good, not only simply or in himself, but also in relation to his friend, because those who are virtuous are also good without qualification and useful to one another and completely pleasing. It is obvious that the friendship of virtuous men comprehends not only good in an unqualified sense, but also pleasure and utility. So Aquinas sees that in the friendship of virtue, the imperfections of the other kinds are taken up and found and perfected. The virtuous friend is also useful. You know, the virtuous friendship is also pleasant and pleasing and delightful, as well as one with whom that I share a life of virtue with. As the perfect form of friendship, the friendship of the virtuous takes up and includes the friendship of pleasure and the friendship of utility. And so a lesson that we can draw from Aristotle's and Aquinas' teaching on friendship is that we should not exclude developing friendships of pleasure and utility simply because we hope to develop also and more urgently friendships of virtue. In fact, applying Aristotle's and Aquinas' wisdom to our own lives, we should commit to developing friendships of pleasure and utility because we wish to develop friendships of virtue. For two reasons. First, on the one hand, the imperfect friendships of pleasure and utility serve as stepping stones to the perfect virtue of friendship. This is clear in the perfect friendship of Saints Basil and Gregory. They were pleasing to each other, and they found use and utility in each other before they loved each other as friends. The pleasure and the utility that they found each other were stepping stones, drawing them into a deeper, more comprehensive form of friendship. And secondly, on the other hand, becoming perfect in the imperfect friendships of pleasure and utility develops in us the spiritual palate, the right kind of spiritual palate necessary to enjoy in its full flowering the friendship of virtue once it's established. For the friendship of virtue, as St. Thomas says, contains within it also the qualities of pleasure and utility. So by having good friendships of pleasure and having good friendships of utility, being perfect, in a sense, in their imperfection, makes us capable in our friendships of virtue of taking proper delight in them, proper pleasure in seeing in them a proper usefulness as part of sharing a virtuous life with another. So to answer our question this morning, how many friends should I have? The answer is all of them. We should have all the friends. At least we should have all three types of friends. We should have men and women in our lives to whom we wish the good, for the pleasure that they give us, for the utility that they provide us, and for the virtue that they share with us. Not all three kinds of friends are loved in the same way, nor do all three kinds of friendships possess the same endurance and stability. But all three coexist and are related as imperfect to perfect in order that the fullness of the goodness of human life may be discovered with others and shared with them. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.